Good evening, everybody. This is a rainy, rainy night. I'm glad you've joined us for the Thursday evening main stage. My name is Charlene Deal. I'm the director of Winnipeg International Writers Festival, and we are having a spectacular week with amazing writers and terrific conversations, beautiful readings, inspiring times together. So it's been a really, really splendid time. Glad you could join us tonight in spite of the crappy weather. I'd like to begin tonight by acknowledging that we're gathered on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional lands of the Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, Dene, Anishinaabe, there we go. I started in the wrong spot. It's like my tape loop is mixed up. I will never be forgiven. I might be forgiven at some point. In the homeland of the Métis Nation, and especially here as we gather at the Forks, which is a place of thousands of years of exchange of goods, stories, and dreams, we're grateful to be here on a land that's so storied and historied, and to have a chance to share more stories with one another. I'd like to acknowledge the great things, the great supports that we have here. You can see to my right the wonderful long-term support of McNally Robinson Booksellers, who've been a festival bookstore really since the start and such an important part of the community here in Winnipeg. So can we give a round of applause, please? And the furniture stays the same night to night, but the furniture models change. They're really quite glamorous tonight, I think you have to admit. And we're really grateful to Hutke for providing really gorgeous furniture for us and, you know, making our furniture models look so good. So, Hutke. And if you've been at the bar, you may have enjoyed a 1919 from Little Brown Jug, who is our bar sponsor. We're really glad of that, too, and we've been enjoying just the tiniest bit of Little Brown Jug product in the hospitality suite. So thanks to Little Brown Jug as well. It's not like I'm counting. We tonight have gathered a really interesting show called Making Do, Getting By. And all of the stories tonight that you are going to encounter feature folks who are in some kind of challenging situation, everywhere from confusion to dire straits, or sometimes just bewilderment, indecision. And all of these characters are finding their own way through complex tangles, which is basically what life seems to be for almost all of us at almost all times. You will hear some stories that are heartbreaking, some stories that are funny, some stories that are slightly squirm-inducing, and they invite us to understand the challenges of being alive in different ways. So I'm really, really excited about what we get to do here. Our first writer, our first guest, comes to us from Montreal. Mathieu Simard is here with a book translated into English. He's here also presenting on the French side of our programming. His English novel is called The Country Will Bring Us No Peace. Please welcome Mathieu Simard.
Good evening. So yeah, I'm going to read from this book that I wrote in French, translated by Pablo Strauss. So let's hope I don't screw this up. We've barely spoken since Fisher kissed Marie. A few words about the sand from the previous winter still sprinkled over the asphalt. Something about the moon shining through the cloud cover. A sentence or two about the closed-down, boarded-up school. The master bedroom floor has a pronounced slope, and we have to find little pieces of wood to shim the bedposts. Marie lets her clothing drop where it falls and slips naked under the sole blanket we found in the box marked bedroom closet. I climb in with her and warm my body against hers. We make love because that's what we have to do. J'ai cru un instant qu'en venant ici, nous pourrions nous réfugier dans un cocon d'arbre et brûler les draps de la chaleur de nos corps. For a short while, I imagined that by coming here, we could find refuge in a cocoon of forest, burn the bed sheets with our body heat, We'd rekindle the passion of our early days 9 years ago, almost 10. But it's been years since such passions rocked our bodies. If we still manage to lie intertwined nearly every night, we owe it mainly to the old queen-size mattress we bought on clearance such a long time ago. The dip in the center tells the story of how close we used to be and pushes us toward one another even when we don't think about it. We flat out refuse to get a new one, scared of seeing two separate dips take form. The sorrow would overwhelm us. We're afraid of ending up as isolated as the individually wrapped pocket coils of a new mattress. Marie covers up her breasts as if I were a stranger. Her hand is shaking. I catch my breath. At this point, we don't know that we're going to be the murder-suicide couple, an episode of domestic violence that will briefly make the news and have everyone shaken up for about 5 minutes before they forget all about it the moment they turn off their TVs because it's getting late and it's time to go to bed. No one wants to be exhausted the next day. Fisher will say he didn't see it coming, and Lavoie will say they seemed like such a nice people. Alice won't say a single word. And the blood from our veins will seep into the cracks in the floor of this old house we just bought. Elle venait d'avoir 3 ans et elle était la plus belle fée de la Voie lactée, et encore aujourd'hui, je suis incapable de dire son prénom. She had just turned 3. She was the most beautiful little fairy in the Milky Way, and to this day, I cannot speak her name. She smiled even as she suffered, and she had Marie's mouth, and to this day, I can't control my trembling at the image of those slightly crooked teeth she never wanted to brush. She died in this very hospital 3.5 years ago. She would have been 6 now. She'd be in school. And to this day, I can't wake up in the morning without wondering what flavor of yogurt I'd put in her lunch if she were still with us. Our daughter, sickness and death here, far from there. Marie fixe le mur, le spectre d'une migraine flottant dans ses yeux gris. Ses ongles poignardent le carton de la boîte sur lequel elle s'est assise. Marie stares at the wall. The specter of a migraine is fluttering in her gray eyes. Her nails pierce the cardboard of the box she's sitting on, and a heartbeat is audible. It might be hers, it might be mine. A small living room, dirty walls, a low-hanging sun, and silence. The truck just pulled out of the unpaved alley. Dozens of boxes are piled at the back of the room, and 3 others sit in front of me. Mary's gaze turns to the black case leaning against the wall. She rubs her temple, makes a weak attempt to hide the grimace as her elbow stutters. I know by heart what she's about to do and the conversation we're about to have. Our cello scene is well rehearsed, though we've yet to find the right ending or perfect melody. She gets up, drags her feet over to the case, opens it, pulls out her Joseph Klotz, slides another box over and sits down, poised to begin a performance that will never happen. She takes a deep breath, sets the horsehair down on the instrument strings, sighs, and then slouches down in disappointment. Every single time. She puts away the instruments, closes the case. Though it's almost summer, the evenings are cool here in the country. Nous avons fêté son 3e anniversaire à l'hôpital quelques semaines avant sa mort, alors qu'elle pleurait de plus en plus sans qu'on puisse la consoler. We celebrated her 3rd birthday at the hospital a few weeks before she died. At that point, she was crying more and more, and there was nothing we could do to console her. Opaque curtains, rust spots on the cast iron pipe, beige stains on the suspended ceiling. It was Tuesday. She was suffering, and she was staring at me, and she was trying to tell me something. You have to do something. You're my dad. But there was nothing I could do, and this made me suffer with her, and I couldn't let it show. She was lost, distraught, trying desperately to find the dad she knew, the one who, up to now, had always found a way to make her feel better. This time, he didn't know what to do. She was crying, and it was her birthday, and we brought cake. The travesty of that cake haunts me to this day. On that day, I wanted death to come for her. You don't get over that. You serve out your sentence, condemned to crawl blindly through each and every day as they rise up like the steps of a never-ending stairway of shame, leaving a trail of blood and bile and an echo of my scream. This life was like a long, drawn-out tooth extraction as the hours following her death slowly disintegrated. On her sweat-soaked bed, the wheezing, the gasps of despair. I wished I could be deaf and blind. Her little hand in my big hand. Just a few months earlier, we were still playing Count Your Fingers, but she won't remember any of it. I'm the one who'll be haunted by these memories. On Tuesday nights, just after midnight, all the three-year-olds in the world are sleeping in their little beds, but not her. I squeezed her hand just a little too hard, and I thought, you're squeezing too hard. And I thought she'd be better off dead. She and I would both be better off, I thought, once we were over and done with this. I'll never be able to live with the guilt that thought brings me still. Le silence est tombé un jeudi comme une goutte de pluie et nous a submergés pendant des années. Les oiseaux se sont tus d'un coup, le grincement des charnières rouillées, les cris dans la cour d'école, le haut-parleur côté passager, les feuilles mortes, le vent, plus rien, le silence. C'était il y a 3 ans, loin d'ici. The silence came down on us like rain one Thursday and we spent years submerged in it. The birds fell silent and rusty hinges stopped squeaking and no children hollered in the schoolyard. The passenger side car speaker died. Dead leaves ceased to rustle in the wind, just silence. That was 3 years ago, far from here. We've weathered hundreds of storms since then. And each time she's been there to tap me on the shoulder and remind me of the days before. 40 years from now, there will be nothing left of us. Our memory and the photographs and the recollections of those who disappeared will all be gone, like the notes from an old cello in the ruins of an old house. Je n'ai jamais réussi à décrire la chute qui a précédé son départ. I've never found words to describe the fall right before we lost her. I can't explain what that particular suffering feels like. Pain like when your tooth is pulled out, but without end. They yank your molar out, and along with it comes every other aspect of your life, which was all somehow wrapped around the tooth. First, your lungs are gone, you lose your breath, burning throat, faltering heart, your bones, your blood. It's your blood that's dead, your muscles, your eyes, your brain, your tongue, your nerves, your nails, all of it ripped out from inside you, all attached to that one molar, all yanked out from your gums. All happens so fast, and yet it's all drawn out over such a long time that you're certain it will never end. There's always one more organ to rip out. There still remains an envelope of skin, and you're scrambling for your crutch, Marie, who's equally gutted and every bit as emptied out. You are the crutch of another crutch, like two communicating vessels. She fills you up with her tears while you fill her up with yours. All the cries held in before this tiny body you want to see move again, that you see moving, and you grab hold of your entrails and shove them back into the little hole in your gums, but they won't fit anymore. They pop back up and spurt out, and you see the little body moving, because if it doesn't move, it means there's nothing else left. The past is all for naught. All human history and these countless wars have only led up to this, your minor tragedy. If her tiny body doesn't move, it means nothing exists, no gods, no stars above. It means that you will never move again, and if you don't move again, it means you won't know what to do ever again. You will never fathom how to live or why, and then you see it move again, that little lifeless body. Hear it quiver, feel the tickling on your fingertips, the breath on your neck, the laughter in the park on the swings, and the hospital screams, her lips on your skin, Dad, her hands clasping yours, her fear of falling, her fear of hurting herself, her fear of leaving in a hospital bed, the fear of leaving, and you fighting to keep your own fear hidden from her, your fear that grows exponentially by the second, fear of the void, fear of insufficient oxygen, fear of your crutch shattering to pieces, the end of everything. You'll always be a fraction of your former self. Until death takes you, you'll ever and always be a mere fraction. Our everything is pulverized in the crematorium, and the urn in the moving box reminds us we can no longer just be. Sure, we'll go on pretending. According to clock and calendar, we'll keep getting older, and we'll keep right on pretending. Thank you.
That's Mathieu Samuel. That's just a devastating novel. So beautiful, so quiet, and so painful. I'm going to say thank you for that. Our next guest comes to us all the way from the East Coast, from Wolfville. Christiane Conlin is a novelist who now has a collection of short stories called Watermark. Please welcome Christiane Conlin.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and I'd like to thank Charlene and the staff of the Winnipeg International Writers Festival for having me here. It's a big thrill to be reading with such esteemed writers. And thank you for coming out on a rainy night. My story collection is called Watermark, so there's rain in it. the stories are... My in-laws live in Vancouver, and when we go there with the kids, they like to go to Purdy's Chocolates and pick out the different types of chocolates that you can get. So I describe the short stories as an assortment, like a chocolate box. The stories are all very different in style and voice. They're a blend of joy and sorrow, laughter and sadness. And they all the stories have water in them. The title Watermark comes from a line in a story occlusion where the character says, "Grief pressed in upon me like a watermark imprints on paper." And I liked that line a lot, and I liked the idea of how water, even when water spills on a page, you can never get the stain out. And it's the way that life imprints on us, for good and for bad. So I thought I would do two readings from the stories, because they are very different in voice and style. So I'll read a short excerpt from two stories. The first one is called Desire Lines. "Greetings and salutations from the mists, my fellow wayfarer." That was how the email began. He was obviously still living out east in the same place on the North Mountain. He assumed I would be happy to hear from him. He didn't use my name. But as I read on, I realized this wasn't some kind of promotional email or solicitation. It was meant for me. And me alone. He was in Vancouver, and did I want to get together? Now, I wasn't expecting an email from my father. After all, I was 38 years old and hadn't seen the man in 30 years. I had just biked home through Pacific Spirit Park after teaching a class at the university. The paths in the park are carefully maintained and marked. Unlike the wild country trails and pathways I knew in my early childhood when I grew up in the cult. It's part of what drew me to civil engineering, my interest in the paths we create, the desire lines, as we call them, as opposed to the paths which are prescribed. My husband was picking up the boys from school, and I decided to use my last bit of time at home to plod through a backlog of work correspondence. And then there was the email. My father asked in his note if I remembered when I lived with him at the Mists, or the magic of the North Atlantic landscape, which I'd been away from for so long. "You were very young," he wrote, "so you probably don't remember much from your early childhood." One fact I've learned as an adult is to never assume my children won't remember what happens, and not to assume that adults can control which parts children remember. Childhood memories are like photos that have tumbled out of an album, snapshots that don't provide the complete picture. But we remember the stories we've been told and the stories we've overheard. We take this information and the episodic memories we have and string together a story. Even as adults, we never stop trying to complete the story. We never stop trying to find the ending. So that story carries on where she wonders why her father has contacted her if it's about this mysterious incident that happened 30 years earlier, and it turns out to be something else entirely. Now we'll move to the Atlantic coast in a story called The Flying Squirrel Sermon, which is based on a story told in my family that came over from Scotland in the 1700s, which is a story passed down from women in my family. This story takes place, a young cultural anthropologist and folklorist. Her grandmother has mysteriously disappeared and has left cryptic instructions to her childhood home, which the character Ondine, who's in her late 20s, has never been to and has never heard much about. And she wants to try to find her grandmother, or at least learn where she came from. So she takes a flight and gets off and drives and follows these cryptic instructions and makes her way up this mountain near the Bay of Fundy. Her cell phone no longer works. She can't find the road in Google Maps, the Flying Squirrel Road, but she finally comes upon an old house with a very old woman sitting on a veranda. So we're going to join Ondine and the old woman there on the veranda.
I love the Flying Squirrel Road, just sitting here. Once upon a time, them woods were full of flying squirrels and other beings that moved through the night. The house is close to the road, but hardly any cars go by. I used to worry about the distant relations who lived over on the Brow Mountain Road overlooking the valley, that they'd come visiting. There was a wicked young cousin who was a danger. I put a hex on this road to keep her away. I'm just pulling your leg, Ondine. Oh, they left a number of years back and moved to Mercy Lake. If it's some tourist driving by, it just means they lost their way. But if I wave, they seem to speed up. Maybe if I put some paint on the house. It peeled off years ago. One guy who stopped come right up to the veranda when I was inside taking a shit. I could hear someone out there, so I finished up my business and I come out. Didn't he go off screaming, "I thought this was an abandoned house," he yelled as he went running off to his car. I sat in this big here rocker I'm in right now, and I watched that bastard tear off, dust flying off the dirt road. Then I looked down and saw I left my gun out. I was just cleaning it. Always like to have it in working order, you know. Oh, it's not loaded, Ondine, so don't go worrying your pretty head. Now, some folks roam the world in search of wondrous sights. But living here, there's no need. Wonder is all about. Sometimes when it's hot, like it is today, I sit out on the veranda all day long and look out across that field to the blue bay. When I was little, we still used horses for hay, but then we got a few tractors. I still take a ride in the wagon with the horses sometimes. The old tractors are rusting in the fields. See them back there behind the barn? You're looking the wrong way. There's nothing in those old sheds, and behind them, it ain't nothing but woods in that direction you're looking. It's pretty in there, but you have to be careful what time you go in so you don't get short on light. No one wants to be in the woods when darkness falls. So look over them fields. See the birch trees running alongside and the line of poplars on the other? Listen to the wind chiming in those leaves. That old strawberry field is fallow now, but it used to be one of the best strawberry fields we had. Sun-warmed berries. That old tire swing still works. You can give it a try any time you want. Sometimes when I'm up in my bed, there's squeaky sounds. Don't go looking scared. That's nothing more than the wind blowing. It's cool here on the veranda and under that tree where that old dog is sleeping. Now, the dog might look like he's sleeping under the maple tree, the one I was telling you about, which my sister Rose planted. But if I snap my fingers, he'll wake up and you won't be able to run. Don't worry, though. I'm just kidding. He's an old dog. His bark is wicked mean. But he's got the rheumatism, and he is no longer able to run like he once did. You can't tell now for how he's lying there in the shadows. Most of his teeth are gone. But you should never trust an old dog, even if his teeth are gone. Sometimes they can turn. That doggy don't like the heat. Oh, I don't mind it, for it never lasts long here. And when winter comes, she don't let your thoughts linger on summer too long. She's that kind of lady. You love her and only her. Now on, Dean, you have to be careful telling stories. Some of them aren't yours to tell. You understand? Bad things happen when you steal or change them. Did you know that? Ondine looked away toward the small pond where something jumped. The fountain was running now. Maybe it had the whole time, and Ondine hadn't noticed.
I come back up here in the mountain to the old place for good after I did my one and only time in jail. Now you didn't know that, did you, Ondine? Oh, I imagine I was almost 40 by then. I can't remember. The whole decade seems like it was one big, long year. Daddy was finally gone then, wizened up in the nursing home. I did go see him from time to time, and he'd mutter away and say things that made me shudder. It was mostly nonsense. A bird flew in the window, he said. A bird with deep green eyes. A hand was crawling under his bed, flashing a pretty ring with a purple stone. The mind does that for some. It collapses like that old barn over there will someday. It never happened to me, nor my brother. Our minds stayed sharp. My brother Hiram's mind was still clear when he had a heart attack in the woods by the waterfall. Some people, they got more astute when they got older. Hiram, he got craftier, but not one damn bit smarter or sensible, mind you. Always coming up with some way to get ahead that always involved putting someone else behind. He was loyal to his kin, though, and he had no trouble lying for his kin. He testified to the judge about my character. When my prison days were behind me, I took over the family farm to work it in the old ways, with the horses in the plow. "Look at old Lucretia Swindell," they'd say, the lady farmer who done her husband in. They never found his body. I did not hide it. It wasn't me who took it. It was terrible sad when my sister went missing. I remember that morning. It was so hot and so still. There was a horrible scream. Daddy said it was a peacock in the trees, one that came over from Petal's End from the idiot who had them as pets so long ago. Let's go for a walk now, Ondine, down to the water. You keep looking at the forest, so I'll take you there. It's this time of day I like to walk down by the stream to the beach. The stream runs fast in the autumn and freezes in the winter, and then dries up in the early summer. But it's late August now, so it will be flowing once more. The dog didn't move as they stood up, and Ondine couldn't tell if it was dead or alive. They were walking along the path now, along the stream. Huge ferns grew on either side of the water, and the tree canopy made for such thick shade, it felt like night never left the forest. The path was steep as it headed down through the woods to the beach, and Ondine had to pay attention to every step, every rock. She was dizzy from the heat, from the exertion it was taking now to go down through the forest. There were occasional water pools, small waterfalls, and strange bits of red and brown seaweed scattered beside them. The old woman's voice was high as she spoke quickly now, as though she was expecting something to happen and she might run out of time. I can tell you to the best of my recollection, you understand, what happened to Rose. It's been some time, and time is like the evening light. It softens and bends things as the eye falls upon them. Do you hear the crickets? Last week they come on early in the afternoon. Sometimes I feel like a cricket, something small and little that no one can see but still makes a noise.
This is my summer song, and I sing it now while I can. There was a time I sang a song in every season, a song for autumn, when the leaves went changing color and the sky went deep blue, the air cold and crisp, smelling like rot, the smell of coming death. Then my winter song, the words I sing as I carried the wood in for my fire, the time of year when the blue would drain right out of the sky, like something was sucking the color out. A pale blue I would later see on my little girl's mouth when they pulled her from the river, and her face was the color of winter clouds, and her lips was like the petals dead upon the snow. When I look up at those black December skies with the big old moon rising up through the bare branches of the oak tree, I can hear my sister Rose then calling to the moon as she always did. Over the mountain, over the sea, where my heart is longing to be, please let the light that shines on me shine on the one I Oh, but that was her December song, and it stopped with her. You're looking the wrong way back there by the woods. You turn your green eyes away from there, Ondine, and look down over the bay. I know what you are. Look over the waves, my girl. They traveled by the stream up to the land looking for husbands and a soul. But woe betide the man who is charmed, for there was no forgiveness for any transgression against her or her children. They had come out of the trees now to the rocky beach. There was a thick fog billowing in on the tide, and the wind was wet and cold, the air briny. The old woman bent down and picked a few pink rose petals growing amidst the driftwood and shore brambles. In the fog, there seemed to be a high hum, as though there was a choir in the mists. There were dark shapes in the white haze as the waves crashed on the beach. The old woman threw her cane to the side and lifted up her arms. She raised her voice over the crash of the surf and looked at Ondine as she spoke. Her words were foreign, and the exhortations were blown away by the wind as quickly as the old woman uttered them. And then the old lady was gone in the mists, and the waves crashed in over Ondine's feet, and the spray felt like cold, wet hands stroking her cheeks as she fell into the water, the pull of the turning tide taking her seaward. Thank you very much.
That's Christiane Conlon. It's also, you know, a comfort to all of us who live far from an ocean. Yikes. That was a great reading, Christiane. Thank you. And our third writer for this half is Adnan Khan, who comes to us from Toronto. He has a debut novel called There Has to Be a Knife. Will you please welcome Adnan Khan?
Thank you to Thin Air for having me. Thank you to my readers, the fellow readers. They're all great. I'm just going to read a small piece from my novel. It's about a young criminal named Omar who's having a lot of trouble not being a criminal anymore. Her parents' house is long and narrow. Two windows up top, two windows on the main floor, and a tiny crack of chimney on the right side. A kid's drawing, a puff of smoke. Their lawn is brown-green and cut badly, short near the roadside, but tufted near the windows. One car drive with a black Lexus that I squeeze past. The wooden gate to the back has no clasp. It swings lightly. The side window over the kitchen seems like a good entry point. The motion detector light near the side door comes on. I wait. My breath in the air, and I'm sure there's a raccoon somewhere I can't see. No shadows, no movements. I move again. The kitchen window looks large enough to fit me. I look around for something to stand on. The light has gone off, but when I move, it pops back on. I convince myself that nothing will happen. It's okay. It's cool. I flip over the empty recycling box and look at the window, a small wooden block in place to prevent it from being opened. It has not been slotted correctly, and with a little nudge, I could move it, but it'll fall into the sink and make a noise that'll travel upstairs. I watched a few YouTube videos on lockpicking. I don't want to break the window or cut the mesh. I want to be a ghost, to visit Anna like she is. There are no cars on the street. It doesn't matter. I look to the sky and ask who's watching. I've been to this house a few times before, and a small memory tumbles at me. It was an awkward dinner, a birthday party, I think 17, and she introduced me to her parents as her friend. We had emailed about this, I was warned, but a shot of pain came at me anyway. Her parents allowed us to drink beer in the basement, only beer, no hard liquor, and I swallowed 5 straight. She drank 9 and puked, evergreen. I held her hair over the toilet until Bernie came down and asked me to leave. Her hair was matted to her skull skin by all the hot sweat that appears when a body moves with sickness. I held her nape when she puked, and even then I wanted to kiss her. I wanted her father to see that. I didn't want to hide anything. I wanted that revenge of desire, for him to know that I wanted her. The YouTube videos are gone from my memory. Too long and complicated for my nerves, I have no idea how to pick a lock. My brain tried to pay attention, but I didn't have the small tool you need, and instead, I snake a small screwdriver from Nathan's toolbox into the keyhole. I wrote down these notes on how to pick the lock on my phone, but the light hurts in the pitch black. A raccoon moves big in the backyard. I do remember the diagram of the lock, the pistons inside the metal case moving up or down, depending on how you twisted the tiny criminal rod. I kneel in front of the door and blast cell phone light. I wiggle the screwdriver. Nothing. I twist and hope for something, but the lock does not indulge. I move back. I should give this up. I can't sneak into this house without a trace. I'm not a ghost. I'm not a ghost. I promise I'm not a ghost. In front of the Lexus is a long basement window. It is thin and stretches half the length of the house from where I remember the stairs leading to the bathroom. The window is slotted crooked into its grooves. I contain myself and don't smash it. I cut the mesh out. I apply pressure, more and more, like squeezing a head, and the glass pops gently, deep cracks appearing on its surface. With a push, I take the biggest piece of glass out and then remove the others. The metal frame singes my skin in the cold. I wish there was something I could do about my skin, that there was a prayer I could say to turn them into metal and gold and strong. My heart pumps for me. It doesn't matter. I pop my head in, but there's a drop to the ground, so I go in feet first and land on my heels. The pain goes all the way to my back. I wait to adjust to the black. I make my way to the stairs. The basement is barely furnished, concrete uncovered everywhere, a few pieces of furniture in zigzagged order, and there's one plugged-in freezer and one unplugged freezer. Next to the staircase, fiberglass insulation bleeds out. The wood is unfinished. It's the meanest-looking basement I've been in. I don't remember it being like this. I remember a couch, a TV, the soft light on kids drinking. That night, I held her palm for a minute, and she was moist with sweat. She hated how much she would sweat on her upper lip. I creak onto the main floor. I count to 30 and examine my breath. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No one is coming. This will only work with patience and calm. The main floor has small lights. Nightlight, microwave, phone, the red eye of the TV. I know her bedroom is next to her parents' office on the second floor. I don't know which is which, though. The third floor has a bathroom, and that's the master bedroom. Up the stairs, quiet is easy. I have to guess which door is hers. Both are ajar, and there are beds in both rooms. But I can see a man's foot on the bed through the door on the left. The foot turns, and I know it's her father by the movement she picked up from him. She had restless legs and would sweat the bed wet. Her father twists his ankle and it cracks and pops. I stand still. The noise moves through the house like an animal would, and he twitches and murmurs like she would. She said these little quakes were a product of her medication, some antidepressant, but here it is in her father. I hope he isn't sleeping in her bed. I move to the empty room, and it's been cleaned out like a guest bedroom, but it's hers. They've moved back everything, all her books and belongings, pens and notebooks, posters on the wall, Hanson, Korn, Linkin Park, an arc of childhood taste. I'm caught by a savage hunger so good that I stop on the bed and breathe. When was the last time I ate? I remember a little tube of Pringles. In our apartment, she would look at me from underneath the bedsheet, her bottom half covered, her breasts bare, her journal in her hand. She would look at me. She would ask me not to look at her diary. I never did. I remember once she left it on the bed, and I stared at it for over 5 minutes, breathing it in. It had a black cardstock cover. I opened it and read the inscription. Her name, her full name, the year, how much of a reward she would give if it was returned. $20. I closed it and let it lie on the bed. Thank you.
That's Adnan Khan. Thank you. Such an array of voices and stories. Would you give a hand to all three of these writers? And now we will have a little break. Please come forward, talk to our writers, buy some books, share a drink. If you haven't yet put your ballot into the draw box, it's right over there on the table, and you could take home these books as part of our prize. So come on forward. Okay, so I'm excited to tell you that the winner of the draw, it's absolutely no name at all, which I think is, that's that you, Bruce? Yeah, no, it's not. Such a fibber. So given that it's very hard to give a no-name award, we are going to go with draw number two, which is Patty Grayson. Where are you, Patty? Just a hint, if it was you who put the ballot in the draw box without your name on it, it just isn't that effective. So, our second half, we have two more readings that are both going to take us into interesting making do, getting by spaces. The first writer comes to us from Montreal. Fawn Parker has a really brilliant debut called Set Point. Will you please welcome Fawn Parker?
Thank you. My novel is about a woman named Lucy Frank living in Montreal, and I'm going to read an excerpt from her first day on a new job. So she's kind of figuring things out. Her boss's name is Gary. Otherwise, I think everything will be hopefully obvious in context. The front of the building was slate gray with few windows, and all of the curtains on the ground level were drawn. I was let in by a muscular-seeming man with blonde hair in a ponytail who turned out to be Worms 5. He introduced himself as Gary and presented his hand in a princess sort of way for me to shake. "So over here," he said, "is where you can hang out, have a coffee or whatever. This is what we refer to as a public space. No noise or, like, colorful visuals." "Is that a legal thing?" I said. "No, it is all legal." "Like a front?" "It's just a place to chill out and stuff," he said. "There's not really much in here," I said. There were four black leather armchairs arranged around a glass table. There was a fruit bowl on the table that contained only pears. I could not imagine a person eating a pear in a public space. A girl in one of the chairs put down an iPad she'd been using. "He's gone KonMari," she said. Gary nodded. "It's not what you've heard about it." "I haven't, I don't think," I said. "It's like modern Buddhism," he said. "You can look at it one way or you can look at it like another way." The girl put her iPad back up. "No one's allowed to have anything. It's bad karma." She looked like a supermodel. She had long brown hair that almost reached her lap and an upper body like a small bird. There's nothing karmic about it, said Gary. Marie Kondo, I'll give you the book. You tidy up and everything follows. It's the magic of tidying up. It's throwing things out. It's thanking your objects. I'm not following, I said. The girl with the iPad apologized for getting involved. All right, said Gary, my office is just this way. I followed him into an all-white room. He had a spread of three screens connected to a single closed laptop and an external keyboard. He offered me the seat that I thought was going to be his, and he pulled up a chair beside mine. Did you get a chance to take a look at our website, he said. A little, yeah. Great, okay, well, I'll show you this promo video, and afterwards we can talk about a few more details. Sound good? Yeah, I said. Gary clicked on one of three desktop thumbnails and left the cursor hovering over the video's play button so I could click it myself. The opening shot was a minimal bedroom set, a round tufted mattress, an open laptop on a side table, and a large mirror nearly covering the rear wall. The set was designed in an online world-building game called U3D, a beta version of which I used to play with my friends when I was in middle school. There was a standard adult female avatar supine on the bed, legs bent and pulled up to her chest, alternating kicks aimed at the ceiling-mounted camera. I've seen footage by Death Grips played over a montage of the avatar sitting up in bed winking, then bound in rope on the floor with a ball gag in her mouth, then spraying a water gun at her reflection in the mirror, etc. The video began to cut to shots of various political figures and Hollywood stars logging into a live stream of the female avatar. Shots of various public figures with hands down their pants in office environments. Female avatar on screen, binge eating, hitting head against wall, inducing vomiting, etc. Female avatar's creamy mask of a face blurred around the edges when she giggled, activating a user-created expression. The clip faded out to black. Is that the end, I said. Gary was grinning. That's it. Sweet, I said. That was pretty sweet. You're still with me here, said Gary. I closed the video player. I guess I'm still not clear on the job. Ah, he said. There's a behind-the-scenes video as well. Click that one. The second clip consisted of a series of still images and short, looping clips of avatars floating in empty black space, interacting with small technological devices. Each image would zoom in by about 30%, closing in on the avatar's genital area, which in some instances would be blocked by the device. A clip of an avatar with remarkably large breasts and an even more remarkably sized penis approached the imagined in-game camera lens, briefly touched itself, and released a stream of ejaculate that whited out the screen. I tried to make out of my peripherals whether Gary was looking at me. I wondered if he was attracted to women and to me. The idea of holding a straight face while he watched me watch the video made me feel excited. Next, Gary led me into the simulation room. So am I just a receptacle, I said, or am I doing the fucking? Both, in a sense, said Gary. Okay, I don't want to be on camera or like market my face or my body or anything. Anything beyond is optional and extra pay, said Gary. Okay, I said. The walls were white with a layer of frosted glass over them, which gave them the look of Apple products. Gary placed his hand flat over an area that had a faint red glow, and it turned into a faint green glow. There was a clanging sound, and the wall shifted to the left with a lot of resistance. Inside the room, there were 2 to 3 people per wall against 3 of the 4 walls. Some were gyrating their bodies, and one was selecting options on a face-level screen. So, Gary caught me staring and moved into my line of vision. Feeling like you want to try it out? I guess so, I said. There's no private area? Unfortunately, no. We understand that privacy is important, but also, you know, 2017, shame-based environment, etc., yuck. Oh, okay, I said. He led me to a free console at the end of a row and stood between me and the man using the closest other one. You twist like this and it releases the console. You can place it on the floor, in its holster, or hold it in your hands. This is the on button. Basically, this starts recording unless you're hooked up in real time, in which case it gives the guy on the other end the okay. Then you hit it again and it shuts you off. This changes the color if that's something you're into. Give it a shot. I pulled at the console and it rotated upward. It was shaped like a Nintendo 64 controller with 2 curved handles and a perpendicular middle piece that was the same size as the handles but more phallic looking. I guess I'll, I grab the handles in both hands, give it a go. The people at the other consoles didn't react to me or Gary. Gary was grinning like he was scared that if he stopped grinning, I would change my mind about putting the console inside of me. One of the people at another console was going, "Oh yeah, oh yeah," and looking at something on their phone. "Actually," I said, "can you hold this?" Gary took the console from me. The phallic centerpiece had a plastic coating on it that he peeled off. He made a point of not touching it once the sterile surface was exposed. I looked at him and waited a moment, and then I took a deep breath. I undid my jeans and pushed them down to my ankles, pulled my underwear to one side of my vagina instead of taking them off. Gary passed the console back to me. The material felt somewhere between a typical dildo and a gynecological tool. No one had made any effort to make it warm, and it wasn't at all lubricated. There was a small dispenser on the wall that I had previously assumed dispensed hand sanitizer, but now, I guessed, dispensed lube. I slid the most phallic-seeming part of the console into myself using both hands on the handle-seeming parts. I'd expected the sensation of the console entering me to turn me on, at least somewhat, but it felt like nothing. Frequently, my own vagina surprised me with its refusal to be controlled. Gary activated the console using the on-screen controls. A window popped up that said, "Now connected to user, come from behind, 21, featuring a small animated avatar of a man in a shirt. Thank you.
That's Fawn Parker. I think that does take making do, getting by sort of to some far edges. Thank you, Fawn. I really enjoyed that. And our final reading this evening is Stephen Price, who comes to us with a new novel called Lampedusa, which has hit the Giller long list. Will you please welcome Stephen Price?
That's the kind of reading you don't want to follow. My goodness. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, despite the weather. It's a real pleasure to be here from the West Coast. This weather is home for me, so it's nothing for me, but I do appreciate you guys braving yourselves. I brought it. Lampedusa is the story of... it's set in the 1950s in Sicily, in Italy. This is the age of La Dolce Vita. Crumbling palazzos, sleek, fast, supercharged sports cars. It's an age of beauty, an age that's changing, in which things are changing very quickly. And the title character, Lampedusa, is somebody who really lived. In the late 1950s, he's near the end of his life. Although he's only in his own late 50s, he's really like a man who's 20 years older. Life has not been kind to him. He was born as the last prince of Lampedusa, so he's an aristocrat, but he's impoverished. He's lost everything slowly across his lifetime. And then more dramatically, during the Second World War, during the bombing of Palermo, he lost his childhood palazzo, which was a great palace that meant a lot to him. His mother died in 1946, who was very important to him. And when this novel opens... it opens at the beginning of the last 2 years of his life, at a time in which he's living with the kind of despair. Now, what he's going to do in those 2 years is quite remarkable, because he's going to sit down and write a book, something that he'd always dreamed of doing and had never done. And the book that he writes, The Leopard, will be published posthumously and go on to be considered the greatest masterpiece of Italian literature of the 20th century, sell more than 3 million copies, win the Strega Prize, which is the equivalent of their Pulitzer Prize, and never go out of print and become a masterpiece of world literature. But he wouldn't live to see any of that. This novel tells the story of him writing that book, remembering the life that he's lived, where he's been, and feeling the past that he's been living with, push against his present, and fill him with a kind of hope, the possibility that he might be able to do something remarkable with the time he has left. I'm just going to read to you from the opening. In his smaller library, he kept a broken white rock, like a twist of coral, taken by a sugar merchant from the natural harbor at Lampedusa. In the afternoons, he would hold that rock to the sunlight, feeling the sharp, heavy truth of it. He was that island's prince, but like all its princes, had never seen its shores nor set foot upon it. To visitors, he would say, wryly, "It is an island of fire at the edge of the world. Who could live there?" He would not add, "A great family's bitterness is always lived in." He would not hold that rock out and say, "This is a dead thing, and yet it will outlive me." He was the last of his line, and after him came only extinction. As a boy, he had listened to his governess tell him the dust of Sicily came from the Sahara, and this he had repeated all his life, though he did not know if it was true. He imagined it blown across the sea in shimmering red curtains of heat, the hot winds of the Sirocco billowing it north, raking the island of Lampedusa in its path. Each morning, he would rise and walk his terrace at Via Butera, his steps traced in the sand blown in overnight, leading to the low stone wall over the Foro Italico, and there ceasing, like the footprints of a ghost. And he would stand peering out at the rising day with his back to Sicily and the southern sea beyond it, and beyond that, the fiery island of his blood. He did not love Palermo, its dusty stone streets, its wreckage from the last war. Though he knew he would die in the city of his birth, what he felt for it was not love, but a fierce desolation that took the place of love. There were greater passions than love. Love was petty, brief, impossibly human. He had loved England, loved Paris, had loved in a doomed way his suffering in the Austrian prisoner camps during the First War, had journeyed by railway and coach north to Latvia, loving the vast, dark northern forests that scrolled past. Yet he returned always here, to an unloved city, to his mother, the Dowager Princess, when she was alive, to the ancient streets of his family name after she was dead. Even as a child in his father's palazzo, the city had seemed to him demonic, low-lying and red-hot. Its dust would boil up out of the sea while the ferries from Naples cut sluggishly near, the souls on board drugged by the heat. That alone had not changed. Now, already old, finding himself in the middle of a new century, living in a decrepit palazzo at the edge of the sea, he would stand high above the harbor and scan their white decks in the offloading as if seeking someone he had lost. And in this way, still in his slippers and morning robe, brushing crumbs of sand from the top of the wall and rubbing his fingers absently together, he would try to banish the night's unhappiness and find his way into the day. In the years since the Americans had swept the island, he had lived with his wife, Alessandra, in one half of a small palazzo in the medieval quarter of Palermo, on the narrow Via Butera, their windows glazed and facing the sea. If asked, he would admit it was his house, but not his home. His true home stood behind thick walls several streets away, in a slump of cracked stone and wind-rotted masonry from a bomb borne across the Atlantic, a bomb whose sole purpose was the obliteration of the world as it had been. That bomb fell in April 1943, and his wife's estate at Stalmersee, far to the north in Latvia, had been overrun by the Russians in the same month. They had found themselves homeless and orphaned as one. He walked now the streets of his city a different man, a man burdened by his losses, not freed by them. For he had been born on a mahogany table in that lost palazzo on Via de Lampedusa and had slept alone in a small bed in the very room of his birth all throughout his childhood and into his adulthood, and for 10 years even after he was married, and he did not know who he might be without that room to return to. The war had taken everything. There was no running water in their half of the palazzo, and the ceiling of its ballroom had collapsed in the bombing 12 years earlier. He had filled what was left of that with the furniture salvaged from his destroyed palace. And each morning he would wash using a bowl of scummy water left out from the night before in a bathroom that leaked when it rained. A most extraordinary room, he would joke bitterly. No water in the taps, and yet water running all the same. He thought of that often now, in the early light, when he would rise alone and wrap a blanket around his shoulders and tread softly past his wife's bedchamber. His dying mother had returned to the Lampedusa Palazzo after the armistice and lived out her last year in its ruins. His wife held no such attachments to the old world of Palermo. Alessandra Wolf entered a room like a door closing, blocking out the light. She was a linguist and reader of literature and the only female psychoanalyst in Italy, and she worked into the night with her patients in their historical library, and he loved her for her mind and for the solitude they shared. She was the daughter of the singer Alice Barbi, last muse of the composer Brahms, and when her mother remarried, she became stepdaughter to his uncle Pietro in London. Upon meeting her, he had been, he recalled, unable to speak. "You will call me Lisi," she had said from the first. He had liked her black hair and blacker eyes and her broad, strong shoulders with the power of a stage soprano in them. From his first glimpse of her in London 30 years ago, when she was still married to her first husband, he had thought her handsome and remote. It amazed him that so much time had passed. He saw in her now the same woman he had seen then, a woman older than he, more worldly, a woman who strode always some feet ahead of him in the street and spoke to him over one shoulder without turning, and whose stern grace could be mistaken for arrogance. But there was such tenderness in her. And because she was intelligent and not classically beautiful, her opinions had often made her company unbearable to men. And he liked that about her, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen Price. What a great evening. Will you join me in thanking all five of our writers? I wanted to say just briefly before we call it an evening that tomorrow is a climate strike day, and I think many folks are marking this in various ways, and we don't really have the luxury of that at the festival with our programming that runs all day, but our hearts and our spirits are with that effort. And I wanted to tell you about a couple of things that we are doing as part of our initiative, I guess. One of the things is we have had to replace our Big Ideas guest because Jessica McDermott is not well and not able to come. And so we have asked Ariel Gordon to be our Big Ideas feature tomorrow with her book Treed about the importance of urban forests, which have very much to do with taking charge of climate change. And the other spot that was Jessica's tomorrow is at Red River College in the morning, and we have asked Michael Christie to be in her place at that spot with a new book called Greenwood, which is a future dystopic novel about what happens after the Great Withering, which is also this is what our writers are also bringing the news to us about how critical climate change is, how important it is that we all understand and take it into ourselves in the feeling place of ourselves and not just the intellectual place in ourselves so that we will move to action. So I hope all of you that have ways to mark the importance of tomorrow as it takes its place across the country will feel how important it is to be in solidarity with change and to make an actual difference as we move forward. On a related but different topic, which is to say the importance of standing in solidarity, I do also want to point out that we have an empty chair on our stage, and some of you already heard me talk about this, but we are part of the Empty Chair program run by Penn Canada, where we are inviting all of our audiences and writers to sign the petition. We're standing this year with Nazrin Sedute, who is an Iranian human rights lawyer who is currently imprisoned, and as we gather signatures from across the country, Penn Canada will forward them to the Iranian government and agitate for her release. It's, I think, sometimes hard to believe that single people have any power, but I think one of the things that I feel every time we invite writers to come into our midst and share their books, it's so clear to see that a single imagination, a single voice can take us places we haven't been before and move us to action. So I'm grateful to all of the people who come to share their work with us at Thin Air every year, and to all of you who come to complete the circuit, because the listening, the energy of listening and taking in is as important as the energy of reading and sharing. So thank you all for coming tonight. We'll see you tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday, and many of you I think we'll see on Monday night. Thank you so much. Good night.
Tu t'aimes, toi, coco, toi, coco. T'es coco, coco, t'es, t'es, t'es. Et on, t'es coco.